Great estates, especially those who were absentees, had their land confiscated. In New York, the number of freeholding small farmers increased after the Revolution, and there were fewer tenant farmers who had created so much trouble in the pre-Revolution years. Although the numbers of independent farmers grew, according to Roland Berthoff and John Murren, the class structure did not change radically. The ruling group went through personnel changes as the rising merchant families of Boston, New York, or Philadelphia slipped quite credibly into the social status and sometimes the very houses of those who failed in business or suffered confiscation and exile for loyalty to the crown. Edmund Morgan sums up the class nature of the Revolution this way. The fact that the lower ranks were involved in the contest should not obscure the fact that the contest itself was generally a struggle for office and power between members of an upper class, the new against the established. Looking at the situation after the Revolution, Richard Morris comments, "Everywhere one finds inequality." He finds, "The people of we the people of the United States," a phrase coined by the very rich Governor Morris, did not mean Indians or blacks or women or white servants. In fact, there were more indentured servants than ever, and the Revolution did nothing to end and little to ameliorate white bondage. Carl Degler says in Out of Our Past, "No new social class came to power through the door of the American Revolution. The men who engineered the revolt were largely members of the colonial ruling class. George Washington was the richest man in America. John Hancock was a prosperous Boston merchant. Benjamin Franklin was a wealthy printer," and so on. On the other hand, town mechanics, laborers, and seamen, as well as small farmers, were swept into the people by the rhetoric of the Revolution, by the camaraderie of military service, by the distribution of some land. Thus was created a substantial body of support, a national consensus, something that, even with the exclusion of ignored and oppressed people, could be called America. Staunton Lynn's close study of Dutchess County, New York, in the Revolutionary period corroborates this. There were tenant risings in 1766 against the huge feudal estates in New York. The Rensselaerwyck holding was 1 million acres. Tenants claiming some of this land for themselves, unable to get satisfaction in the courts, turned to violence. In Poughkeepsie, 1,700 armed tenants had closed the courts and broken open the jails, but the uprising was crushed. During the Revolution, there was a struggle in Dutchess County over the disposition of confiscated Loyalist lands, but it was mainly between different elite groups. One of these, the Poughkeepsie Anti-Federalists, opponents of the Constitution, included men on the make, newcomers in land and business. They made promises to the tenants to gain their support, exploiting their grievances to build their own political careers and maintain their own fortunes. During the Revolution, to mobilize soldiers, the tenants were promised land. A prominent landowner of Dutchess County wrote in 1777 that a promise to make tenants freeholders would instantly bring you at least 6,000 able farmers into the field. But the farmers who enlisted in the Revolution and expected to get something out of it found that, as privates in the army, they received $6.66 a month, while a colonel received $75 a month. They watched local government contractors like Melancton Smith and Matthew Patterson become rich, while the pay they received in continental currency became worthless with inflation. All this led tenants to become a threatening force in the midst of the war. Many stopped paying rent. The legislature, worried, passed a bill to confiscate Loyalist land and add 400 new freeholders to the 1,800 already in the county. This meant a strong new voting bloc for the faction of the rich that would become anti-federalists in 1788. Once the new landholders were brought into the privileged circle of the Revolution and seen politically under control, their leaders, Melancton Smith and others, at first opposed to adoption of the Constitution, switched to support, and with New York ratifying, adoption was ensured. The new freeholders found that they had stopped being tenants, but were now mortgagees, paying back loans from banks instead of rent to landlords. It seems that the rebellion against British rule allowed a certain group of the colonial elite to replace those loyal to England, give some benefits to small landholders, and leave poor white working people and tenant farmers in very much their old situation. What did the revolution mean to the Native Americans, the Indians? They had been ignored by the fine words of the Declaration, had not been considered equal, certainly not in choosing those who would govern the American territories in which they lived, nor in being able to pursue happiness as they had pursued it for centuries before the white Europeans arrived. Now with the British out of the way, the Americans could begin the inexorable process of pushing the Indians off their lands, killing them if they resisted. In short, as Francis Jennings put it, the white Americans were fighting against British imperial control in the East and for their own imperialism in the West. Before the Revolution, the Indians had been subdued by force in Virginia and in New England. Elsewhere, they had worked out modes of coexistence with the colonies. But around 1750, with the colonial population growing fast, the pressure to move westward onto new land set the stage for conflict with the Indians. Land agents from the East began appearing in the Ohio River Valley on the territory of a confederation of tribes called the Covenant Chain, for which the Iroquois were spokesmen. In New York, through intricate swindling, 800,000 acres of Mohawk land were taken, ending the period of Mohawk-New York friendship. Chief Hendrick of the Mohawks is recorded speaking his bitterness to Governor George Clinton and the Provincial Council of New York in 1753. "Brother, when we came here to relate our grievances about our lands, we expected to have something done for us, and we have told you that the covenant chain of our forefathers was like to be broken. And, brother, you tell us that we shall be redressed at Albany, but we know them so well. We will not trust to them, for they, the Albany merchants, are no people but devils. So, as soon as we come home, we will send up a belt of wampum to our brothers, the other five nations, to acquaint them the covenant chain is broken between you and us. So, brother, you are not to expect to hear of me any more, and, brother, we desire to hear no more of you." When the British fought the French for North America in the Seven Years' War, the Indians fought on the side of the French. The French were traders, but not occupiers of Indian lands, while the British clearly coveted their hunting grounds and living space. Someone reported the conversation of Shingas, chief of the Delaware Indians, with the British General Braddock, who sought his help against the French. Shingas asked General Braddock whether the Indians that were friends to the English might not be permitted to live and trade among the English and have hunting grounds sufficient to support themselves and families, on which General Braddock said that no savage should inherit the land, on which Shingas and the other chiefs answered that if they might not have liberty to live on the land, they would not fight for it. When that war ended in 1763, the French, ignoring their old allies, ceded to the British lands west of the Appalachians. The Indians, therefore, united to make war on the British western forts. This is called Pontiac's Conspiracy by the British, but a liberation war for independence, in the words used by Francis Jennings. Under orders from British General Jeffrey Amherst, the commander of Fort Pitts gave the attacking Indian chiefs, with whom he was negotiating, blankets from the smallpox hospital. It was a pioneering effort at what is now called biological warfare. An epidemic soon spread among the Indians. Despite this and the burning of villages, the British could not destroy the will of the Indians, who continued guerrilla war. A peace was made, with the British agreeing to establish a line at the Appalachians, beyond which settlements would not encroach on Indian territory. This was the Royal Proclamation of 1763, and it angered Americans. The original Virginia Charter said its land went westward to the ocean. It helps to explain why most of the Indians fought for England during the Revolution. With their French allies, then their English allies, gone, the Indians faced a new land-coveting nation alone. The Americans assumed now that the Indian land was theirs, but the expeditions they sent westward to establish this were overcome, which they recognized in the names they gave these battles, Harmer's Humiliation and St. Clair's Shame. And even when General Anthony Wayne defeated the Indians' Western Confederation in 1798 at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, he had to recognize their power. In the Treaty of Grenville, it was agreed that in return for certain cessions of land, the United States would give up claims to the Indian lands north of the Ohio, east of the Mississippi, and south of the Great Lakes, but that if the Indians decided to sell these lands, they would offer them first to the United States. Jennings, putting the Indian into the center of the American Revolution, after all it was Indian land that everyone was fighting over, sees the revolution as a multiplicity of variously oppressed and exploited peoples who preyed upon each other. With the Eastern elite controlling the lands on the seaboard, the poor, seeking land, were forced to go west, there becoming a useful bulwark for the rich because, as Jennings says, the first target of the Indian's hatchet was the frontiersman's skull. The situation of black slaves as a result of the American Revolution was more complex. Thousands of blacks fought with the British. 5,000 were with the revolutionaries, most of them from the North. But there were also free blacks from Virginia and Maryland. The Lower South was reluctant to arm blacks. Amid the urgency and chaos of war, thousands took their freedom, leaving on British ships at the end of the war to settle in England, Nova Scotia, the West Indies, or Africa. Many others stayed in America as free blacks, evading their masters. In the northern states, the combination of blacks in the military, the lack of powerful economic need for slaves, and the rhetoric of revolution led to the end of slavery, but very slowly. As late as 1810, 30,000 blacks, one-fourth of the black population of the North, remained slaves. In 1840, there were still 1,000 slaves in the North. In the Upper South, there were more free Negroes than before, leading to more control legislation. In the Lower South, slavery expanded with the growth of rice and cotton plantations. What the Revolution did was to create space and opportunity for blacks to begin making demands of white society. Sometimes these demands came from the new, small black elites in Baltimore, Philadelphia, Richmond, Savannah. Sometimes from articulate and bold slaves. Pointing to the Declaration of Independence, blacks petitioned Congress and the state legislatures to abolish slavery, to give blacks equal rights. In Boston, blacks asked for city money, which whites were getting, to educate their children. In Norfolk, they asked to be allowed to testify in court. Nashville blacks asserted that free Negroes ought to have the same opportunities of doing well that any person would have. Peter Matthews, a free Negro butcher in Charleston, joined other free black artisans and tradesmen in petitioning the legislature to repeal discriminatory laws against blacks. In 1780, 7 blacks in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, petitioned the legislature for the right to vote, linking taxation to representation. We apprehend ourselves to be aggrieved in that while we are not allowed the privilege of freemen of the state, having no vote or influence in the election of those that tax us, yet many of our color, as is well known, have cheerfully entered the field of battle in the defense of the common cause, and that, as we conceive, against a similar exertion of power in regard to taxation, too well known to need a recital in this place. A black man, Benjamin Banneker, who taught himself mathematics and astronomy, predicted accurately a solar eclipse, and was appointed to plan the new city of Washington, wrote to Thomas Jefferson, "I suppose it is a truth too well attested to you, to need a proof here, that we are a race of beings who have long labored under the abuse and censure of the world, that we have long been looked upon with an eye of contempt, and that we have long been considered rather as brutish than human, and scarcely capable of mental endowments. I apprehend you will embrace every opportunity to eradicate that train of absurd and false ideas and opinions which so generally prevails with respect to us, and that your sentiments are concurrent with mine, which are that one universal Father hath given being to us all, and that he hath not only made us all of one flesh, but that he hath also, without partiality, afforded us all the same sensations, and endowed us all with the same facilities. Banneker asked Jefferson, to wean yourselves from those narrow prejudices which you have imbibed. Jefferson tried his best as an enlightened, thoughtful individual might. But the structure of American society, the power of the cotton plantation, the slave trade, the politics of unity between northern and southern elites, and the long culture of race prejudice in the colonies, as well as his own weaknesses, that combination of practical need and ideological fixation, kept Jefferson a slave owner throughout his life. The inferior position of blacks, the exclusion of Indians from the new society, the establishment of supremacy for the rich and powerful in the new nation, all this was already settled in the colonies by the time of the Revolution. With the English out of the way, it could now be put on paper, solidified, regularized, made legitimate by the Constitution of the United States, drafted at a convention of revolutionary leaders in Philadelphia. To many Americans over the years, the Constitution, drawn up in 1787, has seemed a work of genius put together by wise, humane men who created a legal framework for democracy and equality. This view is stated a bit extravagantly by the historian George Bancroft, writing in the early 19th century. The Constitution establishes nothing that interferes with equality and individuality. It knows nothing of differences by descent or opinions, of favored classes or legalized religion, or the political power of property. It leaves the individual alongside of the individual, as the sea is made up of drops. American society is composed of separate, free, and constantly moving atoms, ever in reciprocal action, so that the institutions and laws of the country rise out of the masses of individual thought, which, like the waters of the ocean, are rolling evermore. Another view of the Constitution was put forward early in the 20th century by the historian Charles Beard, arousing anger and indignation, including a denunciatory editorial in the New York Times. He wrote in his book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, "Inasmuch as the primary object of a government, beyond the mere repression of physical violence, is the making of the rules which determine the property relations of members of society, the dominant classes whose rights are thus to be determined must perforce obtain from the government such rules as are consonant with the larger interests necessary to the continuance of their economic processes, or they must themselves control the organs of government. In short," Beard said, "the rich must, in their own interest, either control the government directly or control the laws by which government operates." Beard applied this general idea to the Constitution by studying the economic backgrounds and political ideas of the 55 men who gathered in Philadelphia in 1787 to draw up the Constitution. He found that a majority of them were lawyers by profession, that most of them were men of wealth in land, slaves, manufacturing, or shipping, that half of them had money loaned out at interest, and that 40 of the 55 held government bonds according to the records of the Treasury Department. Thus, Beard found that most of the makers of the Constitution had some direct economic interest in establishing a strong federal government. The manufacturers needed protective tariffs. The money lenders wanted to stop the use of paper money to pay off debts. The land speculators wanted protection as they invaded Indian lands. Slave owners needed federal security against slave revolts and runaways. Bondholders wanted a government able to raise money by nationwide taxation to pay off those bonds. Four groups, Beard noted, were not represented in the Constitutional Convention: slaves, indentured servants, women, men without property, and so the Constitution did not reflect the interests of those groups. He wanted to make it clear that he did not think the Constitution was written merely to the benefit of the Founding Fathers personally, although one could not ignore the $150,000 fortune of Benjamin Franklin, the connections of Alexander Hamilton to wealthy interests through his father-in-law and brother-in-law, the great slave plantations of James Madison, the enormous landholdings of George Washington. Rather, it was to benefit the groups the founders represented, the economic interests they understood and felt in concrete, definite form through their own personal experience. Not everyone at the Philadelphia Convention fitted Beard's scheme. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts was a holder of landed property, and yet he opposed the ratification of the Constitution. Similarly, Luther Martin of Maryland, whose ancestors had obtained large tracts of land in New Jersey, opposed ratification. But, with a few exceptions, Beard found a strong connection between wealth and support of the Constitution. By 1787, there was not only a positive need for strong central government to protect the large economic interests, but also immediate fear of rebellion by discontented farmers. The chief event causing this fear was an uprising in the summer of 1786 in western Massachusetts, known as Shays Rebellion. In the western towns of Massachusetts, there was resentment against the legislature in Boston. The new Constitution of 1780 had raised the property qualifications for voting. No one could hold state office without being quite wealthy. Furthermore, the legislature was refusing to issue paper money, as had been done in some other states like Rhode Island, to make it easier for debt-ridden farmers to pay off their creditors. Illegal conventions began to assemble in some of the western counties to organize opposition to the legislature. At one of these, a man named Plow Jogger spoke his mind. "I have been greatly abused, have been obliged to do more than my part in the war, been loaded with class rates, town rates, province rates, continental rates, and all rates, been pulled and hauled by sheriffs, constables, and collectors, and had my cattle sold for less than they were worth. The great men are going to get all we have, and I think it's time for us to rise and put a stop to it, and have no more courts, nor sheriffs, nor collectors, nor lawyers." The chairman of that meeting used his gavel to cut short the applause. He and others wanted to redress their grievances, but peacefully, by petition to the general court, the legislature, in Boston. However, before the scheduled meeting of the general court, there were going to be court proceedings in Hampshire County, in the towns of Northampton and Springfield, to seize the cattle of farmers who hadn't paid their debts, to take away their land, now full of grain and ready for harvest. And so, veterans of the Continental Army, also aggrieved because they had been treated poorly on discharge, given certificates for future redemption instead of immediate cash, began to organize the farmers into squads and companies. One of these veterans was Luke Day, who arrived the morning of court with a fife and drum corps, still angry with the memory of being locked up in debtor's prison in the heat of the previous summer. The sheriff looked to the local militia to defend the court against these armed farmers, but most of the militia was with Luke Day. The sheriff did manage to gather 500 men, and the judges put on their black silk robes waiting for the sheriff to protect their trip to the courthouse. But there at the courthouse steps, Luke Day stood with a petition, asserting the people's constitutional right to protest the unconstitutional acts of the general court, asking the judges to adjourn until the general court could act on behalf of the farmers. Standing with Luke Day were 1,500 armed farmers. The judges adjourned. Shortly after, at courthouses in Worcester and Athol, farmers with guns prevented the courts from meeting to take away their property, and the militia were too sympathetic to the farmers, or too outnumbered, to act. In Concord, a 50-year-old veteran of two wars, Job Shattuck, led a caravan of carts, wagons, horses, and oxen onto the town green, while a message was sent to the judges. The voice of the people of this county is such that the court shall not enter this courthouse until such time as the people shall have redress of the grievances they labor under at the present. A county convention then suggested the judges adjourn, which they did. At Great Barrington, a militia of 1,000 faced a square crowded with armed men and boys. But the militia was split in its opinion. When the Chief Justice suggested the militia divide, those in favor of the court sitting to go on the right side of the road and those against on the left, 200 of the militia went to the right, 800 to the left, and the judges adjourned. Then the crowd went to the home of the Chief Justice, who agreed to sign a pledge that the court would not sit until the Massachusetts General Court met. The crowd went back to the square, broke open the county jail, and set free the debtors. The Chief Justice, a country doctor, said, "I have never heard anybody point out a better way to have their grievances redressed than the people have taken." The governor and the political leaders of Massachusetts became alarmed. Samuel Adams, once looked on as a radical leader in Boston, now insisted people act within the law. He said British emissaries were stirring up the farmers. People in the town of Greenwich responded, "You in Boston have the money and we don't. And didn't you act illegally yourselves in the Revolution?" The insurgents were now being called Regulators. Their emblem was a sprig of hemlock. The problem went beyond Massachusetts. In Rhode Island, the debtors had taken over the legislature and were issuing paper money. In New Hampshire, several hundred men, in September of 1786, surrounded the legislature in Exeter, asking that taxes be returned and paper money issued. They dispersed only when military action was threatened. Daniel Shays entered the scene in western Massachusetts. A poor farmhand when the Revolution broke out, he joined the Continental Army, fought at Lexington, Bunker Hill, and Saratoga, and was wounded in action. In 1780, not being paid, he resigned from the army, went home, and soon found himself in court for non-payment of debts. He also saw what was happening to others. A sick woman, unable to pay, had her bed taken from under her. What brought Shays fully into the situation was that on September 19th, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts met in Worcester and indicted 11 leaders of the rebellion, including three of his friends, as disorderly, riotous, and seditious persons who unlawfully and by force of arms prevented the execution of justice and the laws of the Commonwealth. The Supreme Judicial Court planned to meet again in Springfield a week later, and there was talk of Luke Days being indicted. Shays organized 700 armed farmers, most of them veterans of the war, and led them to Springfield. There they found a general with 900 soldiers and a cannon. Shays asked the general for permission to parade, which the general granted. So Shays and his men moved through the square, drums banging and fifes blowing. As they marched, their ranks grew. Some of the militia joined, and reinforcements began coming in from the countryside. The judges postponed hearings for a day, then adjourned the court. Now the general court, meeting in Boston, was told by Governor James Bowdoin to vindicate the insulted dignity of the government. The recent rebels against England, secure in office, were calling for law and order. Sam Adams helped draw up a riot act and a resolution suspending habeas corpus to allow the authorities to keep people in jail without trial. At the same time, the legislature moved to make some concessions to the angry farmers, saying certain old taxes could now be paid in goods instead of money. This didn't help. In Worcester, 160 insurgents appeared at the courthouse. The sheriff read the riot act. The insurgents said they would disperse only if the judges did. The sheriff shouted something about hanging. Someone came up behind him and put a sprig of hemlock in his hat. The judges left. Confrontations between farmers and militia now multiplied. The winter snows began to interfere with the trips of farmers to the courthouses. When Shays began marching 1,000 men into Boston, a blizzard forced them back, and one of his men froze to death. An army came into the field, led by General Benjamin Lincoln, on money raised by Boston merchants. In an artillery duel, three rebels were killed. One soldier stepped in front of his own artillery piece and lost both arms. The winter grew worse. The rebels were outnumbered and on the run. Shays took refuge in Vermont, and his followers began to surrender. There were a few more deaths in battle, and then sporadic, disorganized, desperate acts of violence against authority. The burning of barns, the slaughter of a general's horses. One government soldier was killed in an eerie nighttime collision of two sleighs. Captured rebels were put on trial in Northampton, and six were sentenced to death. A note was left at the door of the High Sheriff of Pittsfield. "I understand that there is a number of my countrymen condemned to die because they fought for justice. I pray have a care that you assist not in the execution of so horrid a crime, for by all that is above, he that condemns and he that executes shall share alike. Prepare for death with speed, for your life or mine is short. When the woods are covered with leaves, I shall return and pay you a short visit." 33 more rebels were put on trial, and 6 more condemned to death. Arguments took place over whether the hanging should go forward. General Lincoln urged mercy and a commission of clemency, but Samuel Adams said, "In monarchy, the crime of treason may admit of being pardoned or lightly punished, but the man who dares rebel against the laws of a republic ought to suffer death." In monarchy, the crime of treason may admit of being pardoned or lightly punished, but the man who dares rebel against the laws of a republic ought to suffer death. Several hangings followed. Some of the condemned were pardoned. Shays in Vermont was pardoned in 1788 and returned to Massachusetts, where he died, poor and obscure, in 1825. It was Thomas Jefferson, in France as ambassador at the time of Shays' rebellion, who spoke of such uprisings as healthy for society. In a letter to a friend he wrote, "I hold it that a little rebellion now and then is a good thing. It is a medicine necessary for the sound health of government. God forbid that we should ever be 20 years without such a rebellion. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure." But Jefferson was far from the scene. The political and economic elite of the country were not so tolerant. They worried that the example might spread. A veteran of Washington's army, General Henry Knox, founded an organization of army veterans, the Order of the Cincinnati, presumably, as one historian put it, for the purpose of cherishing the heroic memories of the struggle in which they had taken part, but also, it seemed, to watch out for radicalism in the new country. Knox wrote to Washington in late 1786 about Shays' rebellion, and in doing so expressed the thoughts of many of the wealthy and powerful leaders of the country. "The people who are the insurgents have never paid any or but very little taxes, but they see the weakness of government. They feel at once their own poverty, compared with the opulent, and their own force, and they are determined to make use of the latter in order to remedy the former. Their creed is that the property of the United States has been protected from the confiscations of Britain by the joint exertions of all, and therefore ought to be the common property of all. And he that attempts opposition to this creed is an enemy to equity and justice, and ought to be swept from off the face of the earth." Alexander Hamilton, aide to Washington during the war, was one of the most forceful and astute leaders of the new aristocracy. He voiced his political philosophy. "All communities divide themselves into the few and the many. The first are the rich and well-born. The other, the mass of the people. The voice of the people has been said to be the voice of God, and however generally this maxim has been quoted and believed, it is not true in fact. The people are turbulent and changing. They seldom judge or determine right. Give, therefore, to the first class a distinct permanent share in the government. Can a democratic assembly who annually revolve in the mass of the people be supposed steadily to pursue the public good? Nothing but a permanent body can check the imprudence of democracy. At the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton suggested a president and Senate chosen for life. The convention did not take his suggestion, but neither did it provide for popular elections, except in the case of the House of Representatives, where the qualifications were set by the state legislatures, which required property holding for voting in almost all the states, and excluded women, Indians, slaves. The Constitution provided for senators to be elected by the state legislators, for the president to be elected by electors chosen by the state legislators, and for the Supreme Court to be appointed by the president. The problem of democracy in the post-revolutionary society was not, however, the constitutional limitations on voting. It lay deeper, beyond the Constitution, in the division of society into rich and poor. For if some people had great wealth and influence, if they had the land, the money, the newspapers, the church, the educational system, how could voting, however broad, cut into such power? There was still another problem. Wasn't it the nature of representative government, even when most broadly based, to be conservative, to prevent tumultuous change? It came time to ratify the Constitution, to submit to a vote in state conventions, with approval of 9 of the 13 required to ratify it. In New York, where debate over ratification was intense, a series of newspaper articles appeared anonymously, and they tell us much about the nature of the Constitution. These articles favoring adoption of the Constitution were written by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay, and came to be known as the Federalist Papers. Opponents of the Constitution became known as Anti-Federalists. In Federalist Paper No. 10, James Madison argued that representative government was needed to maintain peace in a society ridden by factional disputes. These disputes come from the various and unequal distribution of property. Those who hold and those who are without property have ever formed distinct interests in society. The problem, he said, was how to control the factional struggles that came from inequalities in wealth. Minority factions could be controlled, he said, by the principle that decisions would be by vote of the majority. So the real problem, according to Madison, was a majority faction, and here the solution was offered by the Constitution to have an extensive republic, that is, a large nation ranging over 13 states, for then it will be more difficult for all who feel it to discover their own strength and to act in unison with each other. The influence of factious leaders may kindle a flame within their particular states, but will be unable to spread a general conflagration through the other states. Madison's argument can be seen as a sensible argument for having a government which can maintain peace and avoid continuous disorder. But is it the aim of government simply to maintain order as a referee between two equally matched fighters? Or is it that government has some special interest in maintaining a certain kind of order, a certain distribution of power and wealth, a distribution in which government officials are not neutral referees but participants? In that case, the disorder they might worry about is the disorder of popular rebellion against those monopolizing the society's wealth. This interpretation makes sense when one looks at the economic interests, the social backgrounds of the makers of the Constitution. As part of his argument for a large republic to keep the peace, James Madison tells quite clearly in Federalist No. 10 whose peace he wants to keep. A rage for paper money, for an abolition of debts, for an equal division of property, or for any other improper or wicked project, will be less apt to pervade the whole body of the Union than a particular member of it. When economic interest is seen behind the political clauses of the Constitution, then the document becomes not simply the work of wise men trying to establish a decent and orderly society, but the work of certain groups trying to maintain their privileges, while giving just enough rights and liberties to enough of the people to ensure popular support. In the new government, Madison would belong to one party, the Democrat-Republicans, along with Jefferson and Monroe. Hamilton would belong to the rival party, the Federalists, along with Washington and Adams. But both agreed, one a slaveholder from Virginia, the other a merchant from New York, on the aims of this new government they were establishing. They were anticipating the long fundamental agreement of the two political parties in the American system. Hamilton wrote elsewhere in the Federalist Papers that the new Union would be able to repress domestic faction and insurrection. He referred directly to Shays' Rebellion. The tempestuous situation from which Massachusetts has scarcely emerged evinces that dangers of this kind are not merely speculative. It was either Madison or Hamilton, the authorship of the individual papers is not always known, who, in Federalist Paper No. 63, argued the necessity of a well-constructed Senate as sometimes necessary as a defense to the people against their own temporary errors and delusions, because there are particular moments in public affairs when the people, stimulated by some irregular passion or some illicit advantage, or misled by the artful misrepresentations of interested men, may call for measures which they themselves will afterwards be the most ready to lament and condemn. And in these critical moments, how salutary will be the interference of some temperate and respectable body of citizens in order to check the misguided career and to suspend the blow meditated by the people against themselves until reason, justice, and truth can regain their authority over the public mind. The Constitution was a compromise between slaveholding interests of the South and moneyed interests of the North. For the purpose of uniting the 13 states into one great market for commerce, the Northern delegates wanted laws regulating interstate commerce and urged that such laws require only a majority of Congress to pass. The South agreed to this in return for allowing the trade in slaves to continue for 20 years before being outlawed. Charles Beard warned us that governments, including the government of the United States, are not neutral, that they represent the dominant economic interests, and that their constitutions are intended to serve those interests. One of his critics, Robert E. Brown, Charles Beard and the Constitution, raises an interesting point. Granted that the Constitution omitted the phrase, "life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," which appeared in the Declaration of Independence, and substituted "life, liberty, or property," well, why shouldn't the Constitution protect property? As Brown says about revolutionary America, practically everybody was interested in the protection of property, because so many Americans owned property. However, this is misleading. True, there were many property owners, but some people had much more than others. A few people had great amounts of property. Many people had small amounts. Others had none. Jackson Maine found that one-third of the population in the Revolutionary period were small farmers, while only 3% of the population had truly large holdings and could be considered wealthy. Still, one-third was a considerable number of people who felt they had something at stake in the stability of a new government. This was a larger base of support for government than anywhere in the world at the end of the 18th century. In addition, the city mechanics had an important interest in a government which would protect their work from foreign competition. As Staunton Lynn puts it, how is it that the city workingmen all over America overwhelmingly and enthusiastically supported the United States Constitution? This was especially true in New York. When the 9th and 10th states had ratified the Constitution, 4,000 New York City mechanics marched with floats and banners to celebrate. Bakers, blacksmiths, brewers, ship joiners and shipwrights, coopers, cartmen and tailors all marched. What Lind found was that these mechanics, while opposing elite rule in the colonies, were nationalist. Mechanics comprised perhaps half the New York population. Some were wealthy, some were poor, but all were better off than the ordinary laborer, the apprentice, the journeyman, and their prosperity required a government that would protect them against the British hats and shoes and other goods that were pouring into the colonies after the Revolution. As a result, the mechanics often supported wealthy conservatives at the ballot box. The Constitution, then, illustrates the complexity of the American system, that it serves the interests of a wealthy elite, but also does enough for small property owners, for middle-class mechanics, and farmers to build a broad base of support. The slightly prosperous people who make up this base of support are buffers against the blacks, the Indians, the very poor whites. They enable the elite to keep control with a minimum of coercion, a maximum of law, all made palatable by the fanfare of patriotism and unity. The Constitution became even more acceptable to the public at large after the first Congress, responding to criticism, passed a series of amendments known as the Bill of Rights. These amendments seemed to make the new government a guardian of people's liberties to speak, to publish, to worship, to petition, to assemble, to be tried fairly, to be secure at home against official intrusion. It was therefore perfectly designed to build popular backing for the new government. What was not made clear, it was a time when the language of freedom was new and its reality untested, was the shakiness of anyone's liberty when entrusted to a government of the rich and powerful. Indeed, the same problem existed for the other provisions of the Constitution, like the clause forbidding states to impair the obligation of contract, or that giving Congress the power to tax the people and to appropriate money. They all sound benign and neutral until one asks, tax who? For what? Appropriate what? For whom? To protect everyone's contracts seems like an act of fairness, of equal treatment, until one considers that contracts made between rich and poor, between employer and employee, landlord and tenant, creditor and debtor, generally favor the more powerful of the two parties. Thus, to protect these contracts is to put the great power of the government, its laws, courts, sheriffs, police, on the side of the privileged, and to do it not, as in pre-modern times, as an exercise of brute force against the weak, but as a matter of law. The First Amendment of the Bill of Rights shows that quality of interest hiding behind innocence. Passed in 1791 by Congress, it provided that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Yet, 7 years after the First Amendment became part of the Constitution, Congress passed a law very clearly abridging the freedom of speech. This was the Sedition Act of 1798, passed under John Adams's administration, at a time when Irishmen and Frenchmen in the United States were looked on as dangerous revolutionaries because of the recent French Revolution and the Irish rebellions. The Sedition Act made it a crime to say or write anything false, scandalous, and malicious against the government, Congress, or the President with intent to defame them, bring them into disrepute, or excite popular hatreds against them. This act seemed to directly violate the First Amendment. Yet it was enforced. 10 Americans were put in prison for utterances against the government, and every member of the Supreme Court in 1798 to 1800, sitting as an appellate judge, held it constitutional. There was a legal basis for this, one known to legal experts, but not to the ordinary American, who would read the First Amendment and feel confident that he or she was protected in the exercise of free speech. That basis has been explained by historian Leonard Levy. Levy points out that it was generally understood, not in the population but in higher circles, that despite the First Amendment, the British common law of seditious libel still ruled in America. This meant that while the government could not exercise prior restraint, that is, prevent an utterance or publication in advance, it could legally punish the speaker or writer afterward. Thus, Congress has a convenient legal basis for the laws it has enacted since that time, making certain kinds of speech a crime. And since punishment after the fact is an excellent deterrent to the exercise of free expression, the claim of no prior restraint itself is destroyed. This leaves the First Amendment much less than the stone wall of protection it seems at first glance. Are the economic provisions in the Constitution enforced just as weakly? We have an instructive example almost immediately in Washington's first administration, when Congress's power to tax and appropriate money was immediately put to use by the Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, believing that government must ally itself with the richest elements of society to make itself strong, proposed to Congress a series of laws which it enacted, expressing this philosophy. A Bank of the United States was set up as a partnership between the government and certain banking interests. A tariff was passed to help the manufacturers. It was agreed to pay bondholders. Most of the war bonds were now concentrated in a small group of wealthy people. The full value of their bonds. Tax laws were passed to raise money for this bond redemption. One of these tax laws was the whiskey tax, which especially hurt small farmers who raised grain that they converted into whiskey and then sold. In 1794, the farmers of western Pennsylvania took up arms and rebelled against the collection of this tax. Secretary of the Treasury Hamilton led the troops to put them down. We see, then, in the first years of the Constitution, that some of its provisions, even those paraded most flamboyantly, like the First Amendment, might be treated lightly. Others, like the power to tax, would be powerfully enforced. Still, the mythology around the Founding Fathers persists. To say, as one historian, Bernard Bailyn, has done recently, that the destruction of privilege and the creation of a political system that demanded of its leaders the responsible and humane use of power were their highest aspirations, is to ignore what really happened in the America of these Founding Fathers. Bailyn says, "Everyone knew the basic prescription for a wise and just government. It was so to balance the contending powers in society that no one power could overwhelm the others and, unchecked, destroy the liberties that belong to all. The problem was how to arrange the institutions of government so that this balance could be achieved." Were the Founding Fathers wise and just men trying to achieve a good balance? In fact, they did not want a balance, except one which kept things as they were, a balance among the dominant forces at that time. They certainly did not want an equal balance between slaves and masters, propertyless and property holders, Indians and white. As many as half the people were not even considered by the Founding Fathers as among Bailyn's contending powers in society. They were not mentioned in the Declaration of Independence. They were absent in the Constitution. They were invisible in the new political democracy. They were the women of early America. Chapter 6, The Intimately Oppressed. It is possible, reading standard histories, to forget half the population of the country. The explorers were men, the landholders and merchants men, the political leaders men, the military figures men. The very invisibility of women, the overlooking of women, is a sign of their submerged status. In this invisibility, they were something like black slaves, and thus slave women faced a double oppression. The biological uniqueness of women, like skin color and facial characteristics for Negroes, became a basis for treating them as inferiors. True, with women, there was something more practically important in their biology than skin color, their position as childbearers. But this was not enough to account for the general push backward for all of them in society, even those who did not bear children, or those too young or too old for that. It seems that their physical characteristics became a convenience for men who could use, exploit, and cherish someone who was at the same time servant, sexmate, companion, and bearer, teacher, warden of his children. Societies based on private property and competition, in which monogamous families became practical units for work and socialization, found it especially useful to establish this special status of women, something akin to a house slave in the matter of intimacy and oppression, and yet requiring, because of that intimacy and long-term connection with children, a special patronization which on occasion, especially in the face of a show of strength, could slip over into treatment as an equal. An oppression so private would turn out hard to uproot. Earlier societies in America and elsewhere, in which property was held in common and families were extensive and complicated, with aunts and uncles and grandmothers and grandfathers all living together, seemed to treat women more as equals than did the white societies that later overran them, bringing civilization and private property. In the Zuni tribes of the Southwest, for instance, extended families, large clans, were based on the woman, whose husband came to live with her family. It was assumed that women owned the houses, and the fields belonged to the clans, and the women had equal rights to what was produced. A woman was more secure because she was with her own family, and she could divorce the man when she wanted to, keeping their property. Women in the Plains Indian tribes of the Midwest did not have farming duties but had a very important place in the tribe as healers, herbalists, and sometimes holy people who gave advice. When bands lost their male leaders, women would become chieftains. Women learned to shoot small bows, and they carried knives, because among the Sioux, a woman was supposed to be able to defend herself against attack. The puberty ceremony of the Sioux was such as to give pride to a young Sioux maiden. "Walk the good road, my daughter," and the buffalo herds, wide and dark as cloud shadows, moving over the prairie, will follow you. "Be dutiful, respectful, gentle and modest, my daughter, and proud walking. If the pride and the virtue of the women are lost, the spring will come, but the buffalo trails will turn to grass. Be strong with the warm, strong heart of the earth. No people goes down until their women are weak and dishonored." It would be an exaggeration to say that women were treated equally with men, but they were treated with respect, and the communal nature of the society gave them a more important place. The conditions under which white settlers came to America created various situations for women. Where the first settlements consisted almost entirely of men, women were imported as sex slaves, child bearers, companions. In 1619, the year that the first black slaves came to Virginia, 90 women arrived at Jamestown on one ship. Agreeable persons, young and incorrupt, sold with their own consent to settlers as wives, the price to be the cost of their own transportation. Many women came in those early years as indentured servants, often teenage girls, and lived lives not much different from slaves, except that the term of service had an end. They were to be obedient to masters and mistresses. The authors of America's Working Women, Baxendall Gordon and Reverby, described the situation. "They were poorly paid and often treated rudely and harshly, deprived of good food and privacy. Of course, these terrible conditions provoked resistance, living in separate families without much contact with others in their position. Indentured servants had one primary path of resistance open to them, passive resistance, trying to do as little work as possible and to create difficulties for their masters and mistresses. Of course, the masters and mistresses did not interpret it that way, but saw the difficult behavior of their servants as sullenness, laziness, malevolence, and stupidity. For instance, the General Court of Connecticut in 1645 ordered that a certain Susan C., for her rebellious carriage toward her mistress, to be sent to the House of Correction and be kept to hard labor and coarse diet, to be brought forth the next lecture day to be publicly corrected, and so to be corrected weekly until order be given to the contrary. Sexual abuse of masters against servant girls became commonplace. The court records of Virginia and other colonies show masters brought into court for this, so we can assume that these were especially flagrant cases. There must have been many more instances never brought to public light. In 1756, Elizabeth Spriggs wrote to her father about her servitude. "What we unfortunate English people suffer here is beyond the probability of you in England to conceive. Let it suffice that I, one of the unhappy number, and toiling almost day and night, and very often in the horse's drudgery, with only this comfort that, "You bitch, you do not half enough," and then tied up and whipped to that degree that you'd not serve an animal, scarce anything but Indian corn and salt to eat, and that even begrudged. Nay, many Negroes are better used, almost naked, no shoes nor stockings to wear. What rest we can get is to wrap ourselves